Welcome to the Front Row Geeks, episode 8. Yes, I finally got the right number this time. I know this is number 8. I'm sure of it. Oh, man, I am beat, guys. This beginning of this year, getting you guys the 3 episodes a month. All this stuff going on. Man, it's been fun, but it's a lot of work. So I'm happy that all 12 of you are listening to the podcast and enjoying it, and thank you for all for the feedback. Hopefully we can keep churning these out. Get you some interesting people, just like the guy you're going to hear about today. Super interesting, super awesome guy. His name is Benjamin Druman. I want to be his friend. I'm going to see if he wants to hang out later. Obviously, he's such a swell guy. A great story. Humble beginnings. He's going to teach everybody a lesson, I think. And he's doing some really great stuff. I can't wait to see the fullness of the work he's been working on lately. And that being his comics. And also his work with the Black Mesa Project, the first Half-Life remake. And he's been working all these years. He talks to us a little bit about that, a little bit how he made it to Tucson, kind of where his inspirations are from. We're definitely going to have him on again, especially because the comics part, we didn't get into too many things about his comics, but that needs to be brought up. That sounds like it's going to be another great story. So eventually, I think maybe even sometime pretty soon, he'll be back. And we'll talk to him again when he's ready to talk about his comics. So look forward to that, because this is going to be a treat. Some reminders. We still have our Twitch channel. David's still plugging it away every Friday. So catch him on the Twitch channel, on the Front Row Geeks Twitch channel. If you happen to miss a live stream, you can always see him again on Twitch, but he tends to post them on YouTube as well, so go ahead and hit us up on the YouTube as well. So another exciting thing, now that we're talking about stuff that's going to be being put up, one of the guys on the Twitch channel with David, Wally, he's putting together something. Sometime in the next month or two, we're going to start having a brand new show, another podcast, actually, an audio format one, so there'll be some new content coming your way if you're interested in taking a look at it. Or taking a ear to it? Taking a sound to it? Yeah, something like that. Anyway, stay tuned for that. It's going to be pretty cool. I'm part of it, too. So it's going to be fun. Oh. So much gaming. So much fun. So, yeah. Well, I'll let you know when all that's up. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Episode 8 with Benjamin Truman. Here we go.
Welcome to Front Row Geeks.
So yeah, it's been since November is the last time I talked to you. What's it been like since then?
Well, I've had a lot of developments in both comics and video games. I guess just in terms of Black Mesa, we are the video game we're working on. We're finally rounding down towards our release date. I can't say it yet, of course, but we've actually got a plan in place to release on Steam very soon, which is really nice, because back in November, things were just kind of in this constant churning phase where we were never quite sure just how long we had ahead of us, so we thought maybe we'll be done in December, maybe we'll be done in January, but we've finally gotten to the point where we can see the end in sight, so that's exciting.
I think anyone on the internet should know by now that release schedules should just be taken.
Exactly.
Just it'll come out. Why even lose sleep over this at this
because
point?
Because you wind up embarrassing yourself at Assassin's Creed Unity or something. Oh, you know, where it's you release a game and it's just not done even then. You can't even call it a released or finished game, So that's we're really trying to avoid that. We had one incident with Black Mesa when in our first trailer we ever put out in like our big trailer back in like 2007, 2008, something like that.
I think I remember that one.
Yeah, and we were cocky enough to slam like a, you know, stamp a 2009 release date on the end of that, and that just completely just didn't happen. We released in like 2012.
No one bowed, like laughed at you later. Like.
I'm sure. Well, I think they learned because. There's this thing on the internet of the Valve time, which is something that they've gotten on their own, just by their own reputation, where they will say, like, there's a translation. There's, like, a one-to-one, like, translation. It's like, okay, if we say we're, you know, coming this morning, that actually means it will be released, like, 10 o'clock at night tonight. You know, if we say it's going to be released first quarter of this year, that actually means it will be released, you know, towards the end of the year. You know, so I think they've learned to just stop giving, like, hard, firm release dates, you know, and they just kind of, like... Until they are like 100% certain that it's going to be finished.
So what? Oh man, I don't even know where to begin. There's a lot here.
Yeah, there's.
Let me start with something a little more backgroundish. How did you get involved with this?
With Black Mesa?
Yeah,
that was with Black Mesa. Really, if we want to go like full origin story, it was Black Friday of.
Oh, that's just not
2000.
Funny.
2000 is like Black Friday of like my freshman year in high school, and I bought, or maybe it was like a couple days after, but I remember it was around that time. But I bought my copy of Half-Life, like the first one that came out, and it just like, and that was like my entire high school career then. For like the rest of my high school career, that was like the game that I like focused on. I would do all the modding and creation and stuff in my basement, and I just like play it nonstop and, you know, download all the mods and all the different games that were people making, and it just, I was so obsessed with it. And that was around the time when I also kind of like became aware that game design was like a thing that you could do, you know, and
yeah.
I didn't necessarily have to be like a programmer, you know. I was always people I think my biggest like thing is that people have always emphasize the math involved with programming, but it's more of like logic and like problem solving, and I think I would have been attracted to that idea. Like if people had explained to me that it's more problem solving than math equations, I think I would have, like, you know, focused on it. But so
hey, yeah. Did you know that programming is more problem solving than
you just like changed the course of my life. Thank you.
I'm a computer science major, so.
Oh my god. Oh yes, it's like you know exactly what's going on, man. Yeah. So yeah, if only I talked to you.
Where were you when you started this? Because I know you mentioned Pennsylvania.
That was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. That's where I grew up, in like Amish country in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, about an hour outside.
Amish
life. Yeah, exactly. Go Amish and computers hand in hand. But yeah, so I was just living in the suburbs of Lancaster in my basement, just obsessing over Half-Life. And I'd gotten into Duke Nukem level building before that. So it was like I had this idea that's like video games was really where I wanted to go. That's like what I wanted to do. Or that's what I wanted to like. I don't know. I knew that I wanted to involve myself with that. And so I would just learn as much as I could and make as much as I could. And when I graduated high school, I wanted to do something with video games, and I talked to like Full Sail or something like that. And I remember I got into like an argument, like a verbal altercation with like the admissions rep about like, I think this might be what have like soured programming for me, really. Was like, she was talking to me about the programming and emphasizing over and over again how much math it is. And I was like, well, I don't want to do math, but I want to make video games. And I don't think I have to know math to make video games. And she was like, yes, you do. Like, you have to.
What year was that? Because Full Sail, I know people from Full Sail I'm trying to remember where they talked positive of it.
Yeah.
I mean, because I know they graduated from there, and they went to school there, and I know they were touting it.
Yeah.
And I go to the big game developers conference every year, and they have a booth there all the time. And I'm trying to think, like, what were my friends saying?
Yeah. Well, I've heard some different things about it, because I think it's like one of those things where it's like a year-long program, and they put you in there, and they like churn you out. So I didn't actually go to Full Sail because of this like weird fight I got to with the person on the phone, where it's like I want to make video games, but I don't want to do math, and they're like, well, you have to do math, or like whatever. So I'm like, oh no, that's not going to work. So essentially, I took 2 years off after high school because I didn't feel like I didn't want to go to college for no reason. You know what I mean? I didn't want to like go there like undeclared and not know what I was doing. And so I just took 2 years off and kind of just like messed around at my house and, you know, did whatever I could. And then I heard about this program at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh that was like a video game art and design program. And the art and design, that was what like really attracted me to it, you know, because the Full Sail thing was like, we're going to teach you programming. That's like what that's like. It doesn't even seem like that's what they focus on. It seems like they focus more on modeling and stuff, but they just kept going on and on. Like, it's going to be programming. So I didn't go there. The video game art and design, that really attracted me there, because the whole concept of, like, I was also becoming aware of, like, game design, and that there was, like, someone's job to, like, kind of, like, define fun, you know, and, like, figure out what is fun, how can you, like, do that, and so that was just so intriguing.
Yeah. And how do you do that without like drawing the soul of fun out of it, magic ritual.
Yes,
we don't want to kill it while we're trying to understand it.
Yes, you can do that. You can, like, you know, if you dissect it too much, and then you can even, like, kill the fun of it for yourself, you know. So yeah,
that was definitely what, because I didn't go, because I'm big, this is, you and I are speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. But I kind of went about it the most boring way possible, because I went like non-video game related computer science.
Yeah.
And everything I've been doing video game related has been about just, like, through like indirect industry ways. Like, it's basically my connections with the game industry by the people themselves, not exactly like anything business practices.
Yeah, but that's what you want, then.
Yeah, I found out that didn't puzzle in until maybe, like, the last 3 years. I was like, why didn't I? Okay, I get it now.
Yeah. Time to start using some connections.
Yeah,
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and that stuff's still in progress. Like, that, now I know that's there, and I know how to take advantage of it. Now it's kind of like, okay, let's try this again.
Mm-hmm.
Which, okay, but you, not
me. No, but I know exactly what you're talking about, because I feel like I'm kind of, like, constantly doing these, like recentering, like, oh, wait, like, I don't have to ask anybody for permission to even, like, make a game. You know what I mean? In this day and age, like, I don't even have to, like, rely on somebody else. You know, I could just sit down, if I really wanted to make something, I'd make something simple on my own. And, like, just, like, this kind of, like, oh, wait, like, take stock of everything that's around me, take stock of opportunities and resources, and, like, oh, I could actually do some of this on my own.
Here, let me throw out, like a theory at you.
Okay.
in that mindset. Because, like how you said, like, you're trying to recenter all the time.
Yeah.
Because I think you might understand this. There's this weird, like, art, but not really, but it is sort of thing that we're in, especially because if we're trying to program via this, because on one hand, you're using this very scientific, logic-based, very structured thing to create art,
mm-hmm.
which is not that sometimes.
Right, you think it's like the antithesis of that.
Yeah, it's very, it can be vague, depending on what the last, like, 7 years has all been about, these vague video game contents coming out, and they don't all have to be about gameplay anymore, they could just be about an expression.
Yes.
So, it's combining those two all of a sudden now, it's like,
where do we all fit in? And that's, like,
sometimes it's probably why it takes teams to do this stuff.
Yeah, well, that's, I think it's the real interesting kind of, like, backlash too, is that there, this, like, the industry got too big and it can't, like, support itself anymore. And so you've got these huge AAA games like Assassin's Creed Unity, which, who knows how many people worked on that game, and it still came out broken, you know, like, still comes out the other end, not done, half-baked, broken. You know, like, there's so many millions of dollars funneled into it, so many salaries had to be paid to make it, and that's, like, that's why the industry is starting to kind of, like, crumble in on itself. And so you got these small indie studios of, like, 2 to 3 to, you know, like, X amount of guys, but just, like, you can count them on a hand.
When did Assassin's Creed, which was supposed to be maybe art, maybe an experience that, you know, that the interactive media is, when did that become a product that, man, now it's kind of broken, but you like it anyway?
As soon as you hear a video game company say, we're going to try to make one of these a year, I think that's when it's like, no, guys, really, slow down.
Where's the love?
Now it's like
we're putting on a schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like who knows how those things get, like... Actually, funny enough,
don't they say that sometimes you need the schedule for some love?
Yeah, but like a
it's not working
time.
For the video game industry, apparently.
Yeah. But I think it's just that they can say, like, yeah, we'll give this schedule and they'll buy it anyway. Even if there's, like, a million bad reviews, even if it's, like, you know, just, like, they're just going to adhere to the schedule and they're going to put it out and they know
that I think
that
that's
they
the crime. It's, you
I
know,
do,
if you give us a broken thing and you say you're going to fix it, fine, we get it. You know, computers and technology, it can be finicky sometimes. But then don't tell us, like, we're supposed to just accept it.
Yeah.
Like, what?
You'll like it. We'll
like,
give it
like,
to you.
No,
we'll
like
it.
It.
Yeah.
If for any reason, because you told us we would.
Yeah,
now
yeah.
we're definitely not going to like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's like the pop psychology. Like, just...
So I guess there's something that he said maybe about consumer expectation at that point too, but
yeah, I mean, because, but, like, yeah, it's really hard to wag your finger and anybody. It's like a fight on the schoolyard. You kind of have to like separate both parties and be like, like, listen, if you keep buying broken games, you're going to keep getting broken games. And like, you're not to take the other guys.
Where's side. Mr. Miyagi?
Yeah, yeah. Wax on and wax off. Take care of that.
Okay, so that totally got detoured because how did you get involved?
Yes, I think we'll probably have a few of those.
Good.
I'm all about the tangents. I've got so much ADD. So I heard about the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, and like I said, what drew me to that program was that it had art, game art, and design, like in the title, and like the idea of like design was what really appealed to me. Because I guess it's kind of like the film directing or something, you know, it's like this idea of like, oh, the game designer, that's the guy who's like in charge of the game, you know. So I was really like attracted to that idea,
like the vision,
like, yeah, like having this kind of like, you know, a finger in every pie, like, you know, you're involved in every aspect of it, and that really appealed to me too, because I was interested in so many parts of video game creation, you know. But I wound up focusing on just like the writing part for Black Mesa. The way I did that was I had, you know, a notebook that I carried around. I was always writing ideas in video game ideas and just like dialogue stuff like that. And I always had this notebook with me. And on my first classes that I had at school, it was like a color theory class. I'm sitting next to this dude, Chuck Wilson, this like kid, like Art Institute of Pittsburgh was a year-round school, so that means like I started in the summer. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting next to a kid who was like, I don't even know if he was 18 at the time, he's like 17. I mean, he had like just graduated high school, had like 2 weeks off, and then
head first
to college. Yeah, just like insanity. Like I can't even imagine.
No,
I
had to, no high school years. Summer movie before you grow up into
exactly.
adult.
Exactly. Mine lasted 2 years. You know? Like, I had a 2 year summer vacation. Like I needed that, you know. But he like right, but obviously because he was extremely driven, and as we tell this story, you'll find out all about Chuck. But like he knew what he wanted to do. And we're sitting in color theory class, and he like writes out on this note the what games do you play, and he like passes it over to me. And I was like,
wait, what instigated that? He just like just
the teacher was talking, and so Chuck just wanted to. I mean, I sat down next to him. I don't know why. You know, there's no reason to. It's not like we knew each other from like orientation or anything.
That's amazing.
I just sat next to him. And he slides this little paper over to me and says, what games do you play? And so I wrote Half-Life. That was the only thing I wrote down on the page, the Half-Life. And I sent it back to him. He's like, freaks out. He's like, me,
buddy!
Yeah, exactly. Instant, yeah. And then Mr. Gottlieb, who was our arch nemesis. We hated that color theory class so much. But yeah, so he was like, yeah, so Chuck and I, we just immediately bonded. He lived in the same dorm building that I did, so I'd be up there. We would do things where... He was a level designer, and he was hardcore into, at the time it was called, that was WorldCraft, the very first like source engine that Half-Life was built on, Gold Source, which was licensed from the Quake 2 engine. The engine was called WorldCraft, and I had some experience building on that, and Chuck had too. And it turns out that Chuck was this like modder who had made levels for like Firearms and TF Team Fortress Classic and like all these games that like levels I had played and like been familiar with, and now I'm like sitting next
to the guy.
Yeah, it's like you're the guy, like you were the guy who was making the levels, like when he was in 10th grade he was making the levels that I was playing as a senior, you know. It's like it's so crazy. So we just immediately had this connection. Like I said, I'd go up and like I was the guy with a notebook, he was the level designer dude. I would go up there and we like plan out deathmatch levels and like build them next to each other, and you know, like talk through. Oh, this is Castro.
Hey, Castro, yeah. How you doing? You're a cute little dog, aren't you?
Yes, we went on a big hike today.
You're way bigger than my brother's dog, and you can probably eat him, but that's okay.
Yeah, well, yeah. He's savage. He's got a cold or something. So Chuck and I just like instant friends, and we were really like working together on these like Half-Life levels, just like working really hard on them. Just like making deathmatch maps. And then one day I went up and I met up with Chuck, and he said, I just met all these guys on the first floor who are also like crazy about Half-Life. Like, what? And so we were just like so amazed that there was like more of us out there, really. And we went down there, we started hanging out with those guys. There's Carlos Montero, Adam Engels, like Jeff Smith, all these other guys who are on the Black Mesa team. Like Carlos Montero eventually became like the project leader on the Black Mesa thing, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. So anyway, we just like meet up. Like suddenly, next thing I know, there's, hey, Castro, be quiet. We met up with just like this whole group of people who were that were just like modding and making stuff. And it was so great. Like this college experience. You know, so it was what I wanted out of college was like meeting a bunch of like-minded people with the same interests who all kind of wanted to do the same things with their like talents and energy. And so I'm sitting around one day and I'm like online and I see that Black Mesa, this like mod called Black Mesa, is just announced. And they're recreating Half-Life, and they were looking for level designers at the time. And so I emailed Chuck. I sent him the link. And I was like, dude, look, these people are, like, looking for level designers to recreate Half-Life. That's, like, a dream job. We should definitely, like, you should definitely apply. Because he was really focused on the video, on the level design aspect. And he's like, I'm already one step ahead of you. He'd already, like, sent in his application. And so Chuck was brought onto this team, the Black Mesa team. And then, as a result of, like, Chuck having already like kind of plugged into all these other guys in Pittsburgh that knew Half-Life, then like the door just kind of opened on this mod team. And next thing you know, like the guys from our school, Aki, they were like 40% of the team, you know, just like all these guys had come in and they all knew each other. We were all localized. The rest of these guys were in Canada and Australia, Europe. They were just like spread all over. But suddenly we had this like huge, not huge, but you know, a collection of people. Yeah. Comparatively, exactly. A huge collection of people, like right there in the area. It was awesome. And so Chuck got in, and then he starts bringing in all these other guys. And then like Carlos is on there, and it's like, oh, this is so good. Cool, you guys are on Black Mesa. And I was like jealous, but I didn't have anything that I felt like I could contribute. You know, I wasn't like the level designer. I wasn't a very good modeler. I wasn't a very good animator, like texture artist. You know, there's all these kind of like skills that I had to learn in college. And it's just like, I'm not really too good at any of these. So I'm not too good at any of these things, but I know writing, I know design and that kind of stuff. And I got a phone call one day. I remember it. I was up in my room at my apartment at the time. And I got a phone call from Chuck, and he worked in like the print lab with Carlos. And Carlos had just been promoted to team lead by this point. It was a very, very short amount of time. This is maybe like a 6-month window from when Chuck got on to when like Carlos was running this thing. And Chuck was like, we've been talking, Carlos and I have been talking, and we think that you need to be part of Black Mesa, and so we think you should apply as a modeller.
And you laughed for about 20 minutes.
Why are you like,
you no, but really,
me.
Guys.
Yeah, you don't want me as a modeler here. I was like, what you guys need is you need a writer. You need someone who's going to handle that script, who's going to handle all the voice acting, all the animation stuff, like all the behind-the-scenes writing stuff, everything that's like tying everything together.
And they're like, what?
Yeah, they're like, huh? Like, you're right. That's a great idea. And so I had to do like write up like a little, you know, formal like audition piece, like script thing, like take a scene and you know, like kick it up a notch, essentially make it suitable for the source engine, which Half-Life 2 was released at this time. It was leaked at this time, and so I remember that like me and Chuck were like, you know, downloading this like illegal version of Half-Life.
So pausing there, so the whole Black Mesa thing started even before Half-Life 2 came out?
It's crazy.
I feel like I heard it the other way around.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's just when things started
popping
up.
Probably when you heard about it. But yeah, okay. It's...
Wow, okay.
So it was leaked, and when it was leaked, we also got hold of the software developers kit, like the technology, you know, the new updated Worldcraft, which was now called Hammer, like all this other stuff also like came out with it, you know, accidentally. And so suddenly Chuck and I are now building levels in Half-Life 2 with like, you know, crazy physics and all this kind of stuff, you know, and it was like such a next level thing. And then Black Mesa, that's when before people were playing Half-Life 2, they were able to build things in the engine and like mess around with it. And that's what like led to Black Mesa, like the Black Mesa Collective, like getting together. It was actually two separate modding teams who both had the same idea at the same time. Like, oh, we could make Half-Life with this new engine. And instead of being competitive with each other, they merged. It was, I think like a British group of people and, he's like Canadian, John Dominski. It's like this guy. But anyway. So they merged and they decided to do the Black Mesa thing. And then Half-Life 2 came out, and, you know, and then they could really like start kicking it in.
Whole new world after that,
yeah,
too,
exactly,
I imagine.
Exactly. And they got real high profile after that. And people just started paying attention to it. And so, yes, yeah, so I started off just writing for them. And it was so long before I even got to like do any of it, like do like record work or anything like that. You know, just, I can't remember how long, but it was this whole period of like study. It's like this, I've been studying Half-Life for like 4 years, essentially. in high school.
Did you get a bachelor's degree?
Yeah, I would. I technically graduated, like, despite of how much Half-Life I played, like, in high school. You know, I technically graduated with, like, my high school diploma and degree in, like, Half-Life.
You're going to do some PhD study work in colleges in that 30 years?
Like, Gordon Freeman, he inspired me to do, like, computational, I don't know, like, quantum physics or, like...
Freeman 101.
Yeah, yeah. That was, yeah, essentially, I mean, that was, like, it was totally my life. Like, I can't think of any other, like... I can't think of any kind of, like, pop culture thing that I plugged into, like, so hard and for so long than, like, that game. Like, it was my entire life. So the whole Black Mesa thing was just this amazing culmination, like, this opportunity then to begin, like, studying it and then having to, like, really... Yeah, I think that's what happens in college is, like, you start having to, like, think about... You know, not in high school you find things you like, and in college I guess you have to start thinking about, like, why you like them, you know? Like, you have to start, like, analyzing things and picking them apart.
Well, we just talked about earlier about dissecting something, like, how is it towing that line between dissecting something so much you kill it versus, you know, keeping it, you know, fresh and alive?
I think it was probably the iterative process and the fact that I was getting almost kind of like an instant gratification thing. It's like if I think I'm solving something about the game, I can put it in and, like, test it, or I can run a theory by someone else and see if they agree with it or see what else they come to. You know, there was ways that it would, like... And also, I just think that game is so interesting and so, like...
I think few people would dispute how you know... I think few people dispute that it's not deep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's, like, so much going on with Half-Life and how much it introduced. I mean,
sometimes I forget how much of it is what they created and how much we just created on our own.
Yeah, yeah,
like, absolutely. What are we making up and what is what they actually intended to do?
Yes, I know exactly.
Which you probably have to go through with, actually. Like,
yeah. Well, that's one of the biggest things with Black Mesa is... You are messing with people's sense of nostalgia, right? Like you were taking a beloved property and running it through this filter of, like, your own experience and, like, what you think is the most important, you know, what you think was the most, like, essential parts of this game. You have to run that through your filter and just kind of, like, trust your gut when you've got, like, I mean, the original Half-Life sold, like, 9 million copies. You know, it's like we don't have the base for Black Mesa isn't that big, but that's, like, we still have a huge community of players, of people who have played Half-Life or other Half-Life games and want to play Black Mesa, and they are...
People probably know that base better than they know their own home.
Yeah, that's like, yeah, exactly. They know, but they have, like, so much, like you're saying, they have so much internalized thoughts and feelings on that game too, that then it's like for us to try to show what we like the most about that game, it's like it could be wrong to them, or, like, not what's important to them, or not what they think is, like, an important or essential part of that game, you know. So there's always this kind of, like, little, you know, people on the forums complaining about, you know, I can't believe you moved these three crates from that side of the warehouse to this side.
They belong there. They had meaning.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard. You get into conversations like that where it's the crates, and even for myself, we released the first game and we got a lot of negative feedback on the H grunts, the human grunts, and they're abbreviated H grunt so we just call them H grunts. But we got a lot of flack for their voices and stuff like that, and their character, and it was like, okay. And it's like, instead of getting, like, offended or angry or anything like that, I never really got hurt by any of the feedback, even though people were saying, like, really vicious, mean things. And I think it was
welcome to the internet.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah. Another thing is, like, okay, I am online, so just prepare yourself. Yeah.
Breathing exercises, yeah. Yoga.
Yeah, like holding, like, hot coals and not screaming, just to, like, center myself. But yeah, it was, it's like, okay, so this is, like, people, one, I think they have a point. I think a lot of it's on me, a lot of, like, the misdirection of the H grunts, not really understanding their characters very well, but then also just, like, the things that people were just, like, saying about those characters was, like, super inspiring and interesting. I was like, oh, wow, there's, like, there's a million people out there ready to give feedback, and if you can put up a strong enough filter where all the hate and bile will, like, stop here, you know, and then, like, and, you know, if you can just only open yourself up to the other side of that filter and, like, listen to what they're saying is actually wrong and how it could be better, you know, just leave all that, like, terrible, just leave all the other stuff on the other side of the wall.
If you figured that out, that one, that could make you
millions. I know, I should write a book, yeah, that's a good point. That's definitely a good point. Yeah, so it's like, you know, we just tried to develop things naturally out of that feedback and find like a better way to understand those characters. It just totally gave me a new focus or a new way to approach those characters. And so that was the feedback we got from like the 2012 release. And now as we're getting ready for our big release coming up here, we've recorded a new soldier, you know, we got a new voice actor. We've gone over all the lines again and really made sure that we understand why the lines are being said and what context, what we believe what the original intention was for these characters. You know, we just like reframed everything for this character, for these H grunts. And now I feel like we're actually getting something really strong that, you know, players, like our players are going to, I'm hoping that they will be happy with it. I'm also afraid that it's going to be this one thing where it's like going to be one of those situations where they've bitched and we've done what we could to compensate them. And now they're just going to like, now they're going to expect that to be, you know, I feel as though in some ways it's like, we do believe entertainment is a service and we are like, you know, trying to create something that paying customers will be happy with. But then I'm also afraid that it'll be like a situation where now they're just going to like,
man, they're become pressures.
Oh yeah, my God. Yeah. They're going to become gluttons and you'll be like, oh no, you have to change this and you have to change that.
It's something so unique to the interactive gaming experience.
Yes.
That like, if a movie can't just DLC something and patch things up.
You have to wait for like a director's cut 5 or 10 years down the road.
And even then, that it's less about you than the director just wanted you to show what he was thinking.
It's my original intention. It's not about...
People expect that if they complain to you, you can go make patch 2.0.
Exactly. Well, does the dog really have to die? And like, yeah, it's like, okay, fine. We'll bring him back at the end. And like, we can't DLC movies. Absolutely.
Oh man, I can't. I haven't been in that chair yet, so I can only imagine.
If you're going down the route, man. Oh. If you're doing computer science, if you're doing software, games, anything, it's like, I mean, yeah, even like software, I guess you have to do that kind of stuff too. Just anything that.
That's right. Good channel. So everyone would feel like if you just bitch just enough, that one programmer is going to do what you say. And the worst that happens is they don't do anything, and because the internet is free, just keep doing it.
Yes,
every day.
Exactly.
Every day. They'll break down before I do.
It was amazing. There was this one person on the YouTube. We had like a person. There's like a single troll. This is a guy like Ranger 57 something or other, and like his comments are there. They're on the internet. They're written in stone. But for years and years and years, he would just troll our public forums and our YouTube pages and our like mod database profile page, and just like anywhere that there was something Black Mesa, he would just be there complaining and trying to tell everyone else in the world that the mod was dead. Nobody was working on it anymore. And we were just like, you know, it was like crazy. It's so interesting to like be on the other end of that and know it's not dead and know people are working on it and all this kind of stuff.
Like, what is this guy? Don't say that. What are you doing?
He's like, where, like, how do you know? Like, what is it that made
what drives guy? Him to
yeah.
do that?
How can he be so
for
certain?
Her? Is it, you know, the gender?
I believe it was a guy, but you're right. I mean, it was like, it was. It's generic. I mean, the chances are it was an angry guy.
If I were a betting man.
Yeah. You know, it was like, but he would just, every piece of like social media presence we had, he was on there every day, just like negativity and trying to like win everyone else onto his side. And like, you know, it was just like, what do you want from us? Like, I guess you just want us to like give you a copy of the game and then, I don't know. I just don't understand what those people want. You know?
Okay. Actually, so another question I was thinking about, because I don't think we've touched about it yet. How did you get here?
Oh, Tucson. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah.
Because this sounds like it's already central, like partially centralized in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Where?
So I was working. I started my comic writing career at the end of my fourth year at school, because I wanted to do writing, and like I said, I was not a good modeler, I was not a good texture artist, I was not a good animator, you know, like I was like all the things that I was like it turns out that the game art and design program really focused on the art, and the design aspect was more of like an afterthought.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking about that. Like, yeah, I met you at Tucson Comic Con, and you were working your stuff
books
was
there.
about the comic stuff
books there. So it was you know, so I was doing
after all this conversation, I almost forgot.
It's fine. I hear you. So I was doing the writing stuff, And at the time, we just landed this really cool deal. My dad and I, we've always been like working together, and we had this really, really great story, and I hope one day we actually get to do it, but it was a...
So he works with you on the comics?
Yeah, I mean, he's got his own comic career. It's great. It's really cool because it's like a really nice partnership, you know? Like, it's
me and my dad can barely GPS together in a car. And he made comics?
Very lucky. We're very lucky. That's I hear that a lot, you know, is that it's like... It's just like a lot of...
I love you, Dad. I'm sorry.
It's like turning his unsubscribe from your podcast. No! Yeah, so...
Now I know if he listens to it, if
yes,
I hear about this.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good point.
So, a year goes by.
You never mentioned the podcast. The insults on my podcast. Who are we going over?
Dad.
The comic stuff. So I was working on comics with my dad. We're having fun doing that. I was writing. Like that. What essentially came to be is that the Art Institute, it's a three-year program, and about 2 years in, I realized that I felt like I was essentially like past the point of no return, you know, like the halfway point. I was like, okay.
With the project or with the school?
With the school. Oh. Like with the degree. Like, okay. I knew at that point I've already got what I want out of. Like, if I dropped out of school, I would still have Black Mesa, you know, like, but I've already paid for half of this degree, like, I might as well get the degree, which, I mean, looking back at that, I don't know if that was the smartest idea, but no time for regrets.
It's a tough decision.
It really was.
There's an argument to be said about whether, you know, how far is the importance of a degree is. Mm-hmm.
And I really feel it was only the fact that I was at like 51%. You know, I was on that end of 50% instead of, if I was at 49%.
Okay, I'll round up.
Yeah. Who knows what could have happened at like, you know, at 49%. But so I stuck it out. I wanted to get the degree. I wanted to finish Black Mesa. I knew that Black Mesa was my best chance of getting a job or like developing a career off of that. And that, I needed the degree. Like at that point, like the degree was like a receipt, you know, it was just this like thing that I felt for whatever reason that I needed to have at the end of this, like this quest, you know, but that Black Mesa would get me a better job than my portfolio that I was supposed to be producing by the end of the year. Because again, not a good artist, not a good modeler, not a good texture artist, not a good animator. They just were not my strong suit, you know, my strong points. But I liked writing and I liked design, and there was this avenue opening up with comics and doing a bunch of short stories that, so I knew that if I had Black Mesa as a video game thing and if I developed a bunch of comic books as like a writing portfolio, then hopefully I'd be able to get a job in the game industry writing because I would have enough writing experience.
Developing this portfolio.
Yes, exactly. And have like a big game that I could like, you know, hang my hat on. So that was the plan. I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to like just kind of do comics and Black Mesa until Black Mesa's out and just kind of see what develops after it. Because at the time, we weren't allowed to sell Black Mesa. We knew that we would just make this game and it would be for free and released out to the world, and that, you know, I wouldn't be able to get any money from that game, but I would be able to get a job, you know, which obviously equates to money. So that was the plan, just write as many comics as possible and work on this video game for free in the meantime. A lot of the comic projects are free also, and so I need to find, like, work in the middle, you know? I need to find, like, enough money that I could, like, keep my head above water and, yeah, like, you know, focus on these, like, passion project things on the side. And so I was living in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I was there for, like, 6 months. I just had, like, this, like, bad breakup with this girlfriend, and winter time and
rolled in there, man.
Yeah, it was tough. I was just like, oh my god, just it was 6 months of like being in like Pennsylvania winters. I guess I graduated in the summer, so I got back to Pennsylvania to like the fall and the winter, and it was terrible. I was just like so depressed, and like I didn't like moving back to my hometown, you know, like moving out of Pittsburgh and then like moving back hometown. It just like felt like I was like, I just didn't like how I felt, and I felt like it was all based on like where I was, you know. I just didn't feel as though I was like in charge of my life. I felt like I kind of like came home with my tail between my legs, and I just needed something like different for myself. I was like working as like I was getting $10 an hour. This is actually one of the best jobs I ever had. I was getting $10 an hour to unload bands at the Chameleon Club in downtown Lancaster.
What's the what?
the Chameleon Club is just like a rock venue, and so bands, touring bands, would like pull up with their stuff. It's $10 an hour, and the great part about it was that you'd wait 50 minutes for a band to show up, unload their stuff in 10 minutes, and then you'd be, and then you just stay at the club and get paid every hour until they had to pack up and leave, and that would be another like 10 or 20 minutes.
So nice.
It was a great job where I had all this downtime, and I would just hang out and write in my notebooks and like work on projects and stuff like that, just like while hanging out at this club. But you know, just like, it was fun, it was convenient for like what I was trying to do, but it just wasn't what I was supposed to be doing, it felt like. So
probably not a long-term thing.
Yeah, exactly. So my friend Lindsay, a really good friend from back home, Lindsay, she had been living in Tucson for maybe a year or two at that time, and she was going to the U of A. She was back home visiting that Christmas, and she was like, "I'm driving back to Tucson next week, like after the New Year, if you want to like move to Tucson.
Run away."
Yeah, exactly. Like, that sounds incredible.
Here's your stick. Like, here's the bag.
Yeah, exactly. My hobo bindle. Yeah. And so I actually saw a guy on 4th Avenue with a bindle. Like, with a...
Welcome to Tucson.
Unbelievable. I've never seen one in the wild. I've only seen them in, like, old, like, cartoons. And I was like, oh, my God. It was incredible. But, yeah, so we just... I'm driving down to Tucson, and so I got to do this real big road trip, which is really nice. I'd never been on like a cross country road trip or anything. I just, you know, I packed up like a suitcase.
Before then, when did you even leave Pennsylvania? Like, honestly, how many times did you leave Pennsylvania?
Yeah, really, not too many. We'd visit North Carolina or West Virginia to see my family and like my dad's side of the family in like Christmas and summer, and I'd been to Canada a few times, and that was it. I was like, really?
So, exact opposite of what I was telling you earlier, where it's like, East Coast is like a different world?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, West Coast for you was a different world?
Absolutely, man. I remember coming out here, I was so excited to see like a tumbleweed. That was like one of my big things. Well, I finally saw a tumbleweed. I was like, oh my God, it's a tumbleweed. And I ran over to it.
How long did it take you to see a tumbleweed when you got here? It took me 10 years before I saw a tumbleweed.
It was a couple weeks. I lived in a pretty bad part of town. But so I saw this tumbleweed. I was so excited, but it was like perfectly like ball, but it wasn't moving. And I ran over to it, and it was like zip tied to a chain link fence. It was like a tumbleweed, like someone had like wrapped their locked their tumbleweed up. This is the weirdest place ever.
Some places in Tucson, they can still just buy anything.
Yeah, it's a bad part of town, man. Not even the tumbleweeds are safe. It's like, yeah, it was ridiculous.
Have you seen a snake yet, like out in the wild? I have.
I feel like I have.
In 15 years, I have. Well, no, sorry, take that back. Only until 3 months ago. Up until 3 months ago, I had never seen a snake outside of a cage or
desert museum. Yeah, of course.
And it was just like some garden snake in my backyard. It's like, oh my God, a snake!
Yes.
They exist!
Yeah. Lizards, that's one of the greatest things about being out here was, for me, just like seeing lizards running across
the backyard. Wait, there aren't lizards on the east?
Not running around freely.
Really?
I mean, maybe they're like under the grass.
I was only there for a week visiting, and I didn't think to consider there weren't lizards going around
everywhere. Yeah, lizards and scorpions, we don't have those. Yeah, so it's like, I would love to see little lizards running around. Such a trip. It's just like a wildlife out here, you know. I moved down here. I got in the car with Lindsay, and we drove down here, and I didn't know what I was going to do out here. Like, I didn't have a job lined up. I barely had a living situation lined up.
You just needed to change the scenery.
I had to be somewhere else. I did not want to be cold anymore either. I mean, this is like, like I said, Lindsay was visiting over December. It was, you know, Christmas break. It was the end of December, and she was leaving in the early January. And I had to get out of there. So we just, drove out, stayed at like a commune in Tennessee and stayed with some people we know in New Orleans and in Austin, Texas, and in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and then wound up in Tucson. And I can keep going. Like, is there anything
else? Please, I love this. This is what I'm here for, man.
Yeah, right. The origin story. So
this is fascinating. I mean, I'm fascinated. This is really cool.
Yeah, to like be out of like, to hear someone's story of someone coming to Tucson.
Well, because I don't know how many times I've explained like the purpose of this podcast, but like the dream of this is that to showcase what you're talking about.
Oh, cool.
That like, because you're you're talking about, you know, living this dream of like video games and writing and developing who you are, and you don't have to be in the Silicon Valley to do it. You don't have to be in Hollywood to do it. You know, there isn't one way to do it.
That's another thing I've learned for sure, and that's like part of that constant recentering, like we were talking about. It's like, oh, like I don't have to ask for permission to do anything, like, or, you know, oh, like look at what this person's doing. They did that out of their garage in Iowa, not like, you know, with $1 million behind them in Los Angeles or something. So that's like how I like doing that stuff. Do you see something, Castro?
Oh, spider sense is tingling.
Yeah, really. I saw a cat out in the driveway earlier. I wonder if he's like,
Castro, good luck, Castro. Yeah. Yes, you will.
I'm gonna turn on the light.
No, feel free. That is okay. Yeah. So, and like, have you lived here ever since? Well, no. You said you were a different part.
Yeah, we moved around, bounced around a lot. So the first place I lived was at this place called, was where Lindsay lived. It was right off 4th Avenue. It was this place called The Myriad. And it was this really cool. It was two houses on one property. One was the house where Lindsay lived and her roommates and like her family. And then the other house on the property was this like flea market, garage sale, art trade place, like swap meet thing. It was really cool. It was really funky.
Swap meet?
Yeah, you know, yes. It was like a little tiny like swap meet of art. Oh. You know, it was really cool.
If it's near 4th Ave, I'm not even surprised.
Yes, of course, of course. And so I lived there for about a week, and then I moved to some other friends of Lindsay's who had a spare room, and they lived out on like Grant and Oracle, and I lived in this like I lived. I remember they were driving me to the house for the first time, and we like passed this Lim Bong's drive-through liquor, and I was just like, "Oh my god!"
Oh yeah, that's also something they don't have.
Yes, that's so. I was just like
that also. Like when I leave here, I'm like, "Oh, the U.S. don't have that."
Yeah, you can't get beer, especially in Pennsylvania. It's called a Commonwealth, and so it's all controlled by the Liquor Control Board. You can only buy them in like state stores of where they sell liquor. You can't get beer even in like a gas station or
Savages.
Market. Yeah, it's really weird. But I wonder, I think it made me have to be like much more creative to like get into trouble when I was younger because it wasn't like available everywhere. But so I moved out there. It's like I lived on this little residential strip. It was called Paris Promenade. And it was this really nice little suburban strip in between like the craziest like trailer parks. On just like every side was like trailer parks and this like in like industrial thing. That's where I saw the tumbleweed chained to a fence.
Pretty
like,
sure I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I think I had a friend that used to live there. Grant's Oracle, I know that place.
Yes, yeah, if you just keep going down like Grant and 15th Street, you had to turn on 15th past Lim Bong's drive-through liquor, and then you'd be at the house. But like, yeah, you have to go through these like crazy trailer parks to like get there first, and you know. So it was just like, okay, fine, because I grew up, you know, the white dude in the suburbs of like Pennsylvania, so there's not a lot of that kind of like stuff around there. So it's like, oh, well, okay, fine, I'll open to it. Let's do it.
On that note, how was your first taste of Mexican food?
Oh, dude, I mean, we have like we have a very large Puerto Rican population in Lancaster, so we do have like good burritos and stuff like that out there, and like Ecuadorian food. But I've got so many. I lived right down from the Guero Canelo down there on Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
I lived like, you know, across the street from that essentially. And so I would go, that is still like
my so good
favorite.
So good.
I mean, yeah, it's like, I feel like I got spoiled. That was like the all right, first
my,
authentic
my whole family is straight up Mexican. We're Mexican and we go there all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just like great. We're like, do we grill our own meat or should we just let's just go.
Yeah,
let's
just that's go. So good. I love it. I mean they kept me alive when I got here because I was really trying to save money. And Guero, I had this crazy scam at Guero. Not like a bad scam, but just like a, how can I spend a dollar or two today and like eat all day?
Eat so well.
And what I would do is I would go up to the counter and I would buy two corn tortillas for like a dollar. And then I would take those tortillas over to the salad bar and just like fill them up in as many vegetables as I could. Wrap them up in foil because they got foil over there. Wrap those up in foil, and that was lunch and dinner. You know? And that's like just a dollar.
Did you get the chilies?
Oh yeah, of course hot chilies.
Good, good.
That's ooh, ooh. But
bread and butter.
Yeah, that's another, like moving down here. I've suddenly got a taste for hot food, which I never had, never ever had in Pennsylvania. you know, you just kind of have to adapt to it down here, though. But, yeah, so, I mean, that was, I was down there for a while. And then I moved into this crappy little studio apartment that was, like, half the size of this dining room here. I mean, it was so small. And I lived there, and it was cheap. It was $400 flat for rent and all my utilities. It was a month-to-month thing. And nice. I was still trying to do that thing where, like, I'm gonna work just enough to keep my head above water. Like I have not accumulated any wealth. You know what I mean?
So I was like I was gonna ask you next, how did you keep it, all that up?
Yeah,
because like, you still had Black Mesa Project, you still had the comics.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
How were you keeping that going? Because that takes something more than it took something.
It's stubbornness. I was like, I am not gonna work in a restaurant. I was like, because that's the weird thing about this. And I listen to like a lot of comedy podcasts, and so I hear. It's kind of same sentiment from like a lot of comedy podcasts, from like stand-up comedians or like other comic people. It's like, I have nothing to like fall back on, you know, like no plan B essentially. So if I don't get a job in any of these fields, like I'm going to be waiting and bussing tables my whole life, you know, like I'm determined not to do that. I have to find
respectable work, but
oh, yeah, I don't, my first job was working in a snack bar. And I'm not a cook. I mean, my girlfriend will tell you, like, she probably laments it every night while she's
preparing dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get out of here. But, like, I'm not a good cook. So I was working at a snack bar, and I was, like, trying to make people food. And I was always, like, making burgers that, like, weren't cooked all the way through. Or, like, I was just messing up everything. And, like, I'm trying. I'm not trying to do a bad job. I just have no aptitude
for this. This isn't writing or design, so.
I just have no aptitude for it. And so I that's a good point. Like, I don't mean to speak down about those jobs or anything because, you know.
I know better, but
yeah,
trolls.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Yeah. I don't want to upset anyone.
You damn know. Trolls.
They're out there. They're definitely out there. But I did not want to, like, and I had a friend, my friend Chris, one of my best friends, and he's worked in restaurants, like, his whole life so that he could do, like, touring with band stuff like that, you know. So I know that, like, the restaurant life is also, like, really good to kind of, like, help supplement, you know, your passions and things, you know. So I know it's like a good field. But anyway, I got out here. I was at my old house down there by Lynn Bong's, and I was cleaning up my room, and I was listening to the radio. My roommates had the radio on. Like,
radio?
For you podcast listeners. This is this is radio that you could not control the programs coming out of the speakers.
What?
Yes, I know, you damn kids. So it was a...
I'm sorry, sir. I'm a millennial. What are you talking about? You don't use Spotify?
Yeah,
you exactly. Monster.
Yeah, Spotify and iTunes. They changed the whole game. But so I was listening to the radio, and I heard this woman on there, and she's accepting this award at the Poetry Center. And so she'd be reading this poetry. It's Stephanie Balzer. She's going to be accepting this award at the Poetry Center at the U of A. It's like, you know, prestigious poetry award. And she's talking. It's like, oh, poetry sounds very cool. It's like very cool and kind of snarky and like interesting and a lot of really, really cool symbolism and stuff like that. I really liked what I heard her talking about, her actual work. And then she started talking about what she does as her day job. You know, like, she's not a professional poet. I mean, she's a paid poet, but she's not, like, that's not what she does, you know. So, which is kind of like that Tucson lifestyle where everyone is, like, just has this kind of, like, spread of, like, things that they do, like, piece together. And
I do financial advising high-rise gardening.
Jeez, that's
like, the random thing I can think of.
There you go, high-rise gardening. Like, yeah, it's like setting the planter boxes outside of skyscraper
Fun
windows.
Fact, there's only, like, three places I can do that.
Yeah, not a lot of second stories even here. Yeah, business is bad, guys.
When they start building those apartments near the U of A, I was back in business.
Finally, yeah. Everyone else hates them, but you were on board. Yeah. So I went down to talk to Balzer. Stephanie Balzer. Then she's talking about what she does during the day, like her actual job. And what she did was she was the executive director of this program called Voices Inc. That was like a documentary arts program that like kids would come in and like underserved, underprivileged like students, you know, kids from like crappy school districts or, you know, who might not have like the best home life, those kind of things. Like, they were trying to focus on those kind of kids and giving them job experience that wasn't like, you know, like pulling weeds by the highway. You know what I mean? Because that's like the kind of job
rewarding.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, and you're not going to give a kid who doesn't have opportunity or, like, you know, resources to show him there are opportunities out there. Like, he's never going to know that he can, like, be more than, you know, someone pulling weeds out of the highway for, like, you know, minimum wage. Like, you know, unless he gets an opportunity to, like, do some of this like writing. It was like documentary work, and they would do writing that would go in the newspaper, they'd do writing that would go on the radio, writing that would be published in like the Tucson Weekly or like the Tucson Sentinel or something, whatever. I mean, so many newspapers.
Citizen,
yeah, right. Kind of like folded. Yeah, so they would.
Who reads newspapers?
Yeah, exactly.
Millennials, come on.
Millennials.
No joke, the only time I've bought a newspaper in the last 5 years was my East Coast family. They wanted a copy of the Arizona Republic for when the Patriots won. This last time. And this is the first time in 5 years I've bought a newspaper.
It's like, someone's like, yeah, someone at the newspaper office is like, oh my god, sales are
sale!
Up! Yeah, we sold one for a quarter. It's like yelling to
me. Mexican dollar!
Yeah, like, wow.
Inflation!
Yeah, things are rough, holy cow. But, yeah, so I went down. I heard this, like, this thing that she was doing, this, like, organization. It sounded like something I had been, like, kicking around in my head when I was trying to figure out what to do before I was moving to Tucson. I was like, what if I just, like, went to, like, a third world country and, like, interviewed people there, or, like, talked to people there. Like, I was, like, so desperate to, like, I returned, you know, like, you leave for college, the grand adventure, and then, like, yeah, like I returned home, and like I said, yep. Like I had my tail between my legs, and I was just like, I need something different, you know. And so I was like, what could I do? I could write other people's stories, or, you know, like try to like meet other people and write their stories, or like try to figure out. I just was so desperate for like something new and different, you know. So I got down here and I heard that on the radio that there was actually an organization in Tucson that did that, and that was like so crazy and cool to me and like surprising. And so I went down to the Poetry Center to meet Stephanie Balzer while she was you know, down there, like, accepting her reward. And I wanted to see her and introduce myself to her and see if I could just, if there was anything I could do as part of her organization. Because I was writing this comic book at the time, and I was actually getting paid for it, which was really nice. So I was living off of that, but I wasn't out and about. You know, I wasn't, like, in Tucson, like, living it up, you know.
You're just throwing cash everywhere you
went? Yeah, just making it rain all up and down Oracle. It's a very bad place to be flashing huge lots
in
of money.
In the Wet Oak and
Yeah, exactly. They loved it in there. It was great. So I went down there, I introduced myself to her, and she said they had like a volunteer position open there. And so I was like, oh, that's great. And so I went down there downtown, Pennington Street downtown, right around the corner from the library, next City High School, which is there. They were in the office building that was like attached to City High. So I was down there at this office, and after City High let out, it was an after school program, and so City High School had let out, and then the Voices program would start in the city. They would use the City High classrooms. So I started volunteering there, and I got along, like, immediately. I just, like, clicked with so many of the kids that were there. You know, it was, like, really interesting. It was really fun. I've always worked with kids. Like, in that period of time when I wasn't, like, going to college, I was, like, a nanny for 2 years in Lancaster, just, like, you know, just a 4- and a 5-year-old, just, like, waking them up every morning and taking them to school and, like, picking them up and, you know, trying to, like, prepare dinner, like, cans of SpaghettiOs, like, that kind of stuff. And it was, like, trying
not
to...
Not Widow Canelo?
Yeah, nah, this is in Lancaster. This is in Pennsylvania. Yeah, I had no idea. I would have ordered if I could.
It'll be here in 2 days, kids.
Yes, except airmail can come down the chimney or something. But it was... Yeah, so I'd always worked with kids, and so I knew that also, like, the youth aspect of this really appealed to me, like, working with, like, you know, serving, like, young people and, like, working with them, and just because they're interesting and cool.
I'm so happy to know that you moved all the way from Pittsburgh, and you got trapped trapped in a good way, though.
Yeah, yeah.
In the nonprofit world that Tucson can pull you into.
Yeah, I can't believe that. Yeah. Oh, they got me. They got me.
Like, I'm not directly connected to anything like that, but I know a lot of people who are, and it's just like, it's fascinating.
I'm sure.
And you're just another victim.
I want to meet more of these people, because that sounds funny. I hear a lot of stories about people moving down here And their car is breaking down, and they just never leave. They just like car breaks down, and then before they know it, they've like got roots here and don't want to go anywhere. You know, and that's just like another way.
I was going to LA, but this turned out to be better.
Yeah, exactly. There we are. Yeah, so it's so I just started working there. I was volunteering, and I got along with the kids, and I got along with the staff really well. There's one woman in there in particular, Katie Johnson Gindel Sparger. And she was just a few years older than me, but she was like essentially just like my mentor. And I guess she really liked, she saw how well I was getting along with the kids and stuff. And so they proposed to me that they had an open AmeriCorps position there, which is like a paid position then. And they're like, well, if you're going to be volunteering and you're going to be here every day, you might as well be, you know, getting a little bit of money for it. It's like, okay, that sounds very nice. And so I, you know, did the AmeriCorps thing, which is also a very rewarding and very cool experience. And so I was just, you know, part of Voices through AmeriCorps, doing all these things, running a radio program, like, you know, getting kids stories and then, you know, teaching kids how to be really good storytellers, boiling their stories down to, you know, their core components and like, you know, trying to get stories in under 400 words and still have, you know, like meaning and theme and all these good things in there. And then recording the stories and then, you know, putting those stories on the radio like KXCI, stuff like that. So it was a real interesting just like set of skills that I got to develop then, which also funneled directly into the Black Mesa stuff we were doing, where it's like writing dialogue, you know, boiling dialogue down into like the shortest, most important stuff, then recording the people and then, you know, trying to figure out what to do with all the recording stuff. So there's all these, like you're saying, like all the Tucson skills, you know, there's like everything was just like a kind of a spread, you know, everything was like working everywhere. You know, I was lucky enough that I found, you know, an outlet for everything I wanted to do. And I found that I could, you know, use the same skills over here, you know, in this way also. And so that was really nice. And, but eventually Tucson nonprofit world, the nonprofit just like essentially ran out of funding. There was like a second, oh, that was another reason that I moved out here, was economic crisis, was the story we were working on. They had all these, the comic that my dad and I were working on at the time was called Interstation. It was like a steampunk Heart of Darkness. It was really cool. And like I said,
Interstation, you know, that Interstellar guy ripped you off.
I know, yeah, whoever that nobody is. Yeah. It was Interstation because in the Heart of Darkness, the Marlowe travels to all these stations from the outer to the middle to like the inner station.
I knew I read that book a year ago for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Here you for go. This conversation.
There will be a test at the end of this podcast. So we called it the inner station because that was like the steampunk thing was also like interplanetary. And so this guy was like traveling to try to get to, it was like the story was like Avatar.
I'm sold.
Yeah, so were we. It was like Avatar meets Apocalypse Now. And Apocalypse Now is also based off Heart of Darkness. But it was really fun. It was really cool. He was like trying to get to the interstation, which was just like a planet, you know. So that's what we called the interstation.
Wow.
It was awesome. I wish we could have finished
it. Oh, it sounds so good.
It was. I mean, we really liked it. And it was going to be released in like a webcomic form, like 7 pages every, you know, week or month or whatever. And then all be collected eventually in a book. But so there was economic collapse. There was a big, like, I felt like my life has just been on this kind of like constant trajectory where all my like big like formative steps just get like some kind of like global tragedy occurs. Like I was 11 days from my 18th birthday when September 11th happened. It's like, fuck. Like, I thought I was going to be drafted and, you know, sent to die in a desert, you know, like, and that really, I think that might have been responsible for some like psychological reasons that I didn't go right off to college afterwards. Now that I think about
it, if I hide, they won't find me.
That's exactly. Put my head in the sand and not answer.
Ironically, me,
yeah. Unironically. And then
did I use that wrong?
That's fine. Coincidentally, or who knows? It's
okay. Well, because I thought you said, because you said you're gonna go die in some desert.
Oh, and here I am in Tucson.
No, yes, but also because you said you put your head in the sand to hide. I thought that was ironic.
Yeah,
maybe not. You're the writer. Like, you tell me. I'm a programmer,
dude. I've got terrible grammar. I work at a high school now, and I'll walk into an English room, and they'll have something about like, you know, clauses, like, you know. This is just something on a blackboard or a whiteboard, and I'll just like,
I still don't know how to use who and whom yet.
Yeah, that, me neither. I know a knock knock joke though, that it's like, knock knock, who's there, to who, And the answer is, to whom? And so I think that, I haven't been able to put that into practice yet, but I think that's like...
Something.
It's something. There's something I could learn there. I just gotta take the time to learn it now. But, yeah, so... Yeah, and then I graduated college, and then just economic collapse, you know what I mean? And the comic that we were working on lost all these investors, and we were still able to kind of like keep it moving and keep getting paid for it for a little bit after that, you know, until I moved here. And then just like they just ran out of money and all their investors pulled out, and the comic had to be completely scrapped. It's such a bummer.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was a total bummer. But yeah, so it's, I feel like all these moments where I've been like, all right, finally, here we go. And then just it's like big, what do they call it? You hit the gophers or whatever at
the whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole, yeah, just like a big mallet out of the sky, like every time I'm like trying to do something, like taking my next step. Is like,
yeah!
Exactly. So I'm hoping, I've been doing all right recently, so fingers crossed.
Now you're just like
putting your head on the mole,
like what? Nothing's coming, right?
Yeah, exactly. Keep your eyes out for the mallet. So, yeah.
That should be on a bumper sticker somewhere.
Yes. Philosophy. That is exactly. It's a perfect like life philosophy that could be encapsulated in to the size of a bumper sticker.
Like just have a graphic of a mole sticking his head out to go along with it.
Yeah, yeah, the big mallet on the other side. But I was down here and I was like, okay, now I definitely need to get a job because you know. So I was volunteering there. I didn't need money because volunteering there, I was getting paid to do the pages. But then that fell through, and then they gave me this AmeriCorps job. And so then I was like, finally, okay, great, I'm making enough money. It was like terrible money. It was like a stipend. It was, you know, just like nothing. It was just like pennies, you know. Not really, but it was nothing. Not a living wage by any means, but it was enough to, like I said, like $400 flat for rent and utilities, everything, a place of my own. I could just like go and do whatever I wanted to month to month. So I was able to, through AmeriCorps, kind of then still keep my head above water and just, like, use that money that was coming in to, you know, give me a house and buy groceries. And, like, that was it, you know. I've never been much of a spender, you know. So I just...
It's probably a good thing.
Yeah, it definitely... It's come in handy, for sure. I get that from my mom, definitely. But it's, you know... So I didn't need a lot. I just stayed very, very low-key, you know, not have... I did not have many needs, you know. It's like I needed food and a place to sleep, and that was good for me. Occasional beers, you know, because if you live off Fourth Avenue, you kind of have to. Yeah,
it's part of like rent.
Yeah. It's part of rent. Yeah. It's like you have to drink two beers with that rent check. So, I just kept doing that, and then eventually Voices dissolved, ran out of money because there was like another economic like problem down the line. Yeah, it was crumbling. And so then that was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, the only reason that I'm, like, essentially still in Tucson just, like, dissolved. And I have no idea what I'm going to do to, like, make a living here, essentially. And so then I got a job when Voices disintegrated. While I was working at Voices, since I'd be at the office almost every day, I developed a relationship with City High School next door, which is, like, a charter school. Which means that you don't need credentials to be a teacher there. You just need like life experience, and the staff has to like you. So,
and some ability, maybe.
Yeah. A little bit. So as soon as Voices like dissolved, then I just kind of like walked across the, you know, went through the door and like, what do you got for me? Like, so I taught like an after school program over there for a little, and now I'm there every day as like a teacher in the afternoons. They just like gave me a job there.
What are you teaching?
I do newspaper, and I do digital storytelling, and I do game art and design.
That's so cool!
Yeah, and I do lunch detention too, which is
really that funny. Is so cool.
It is. It's like you gotta be a character for that. You know, it's like you have to put on like a. You have to be a different person for lunch detention. Good to be quiet.
Look, Mr. Ben.
Yeah. Luckily, it's a good school, and the kids there aren't. Getting lunch, you know, they're not getting like detentions for any kind of like behavior problems or anything like that. You know, it's a charter school. There's only like 200 students there. You know,
those were the days. I used to go to charter school.
Yeah, cool, man. Oh, that's so good times. That's awesome. What school? If you don't know,
Vail High School.
Vail.
Vail Academy.
Yeah, I hear. I've actually the people that I worked with in AmeriCorps worked at Veil, and they said it was like an amazing.
Yeah,
like,
no, I really love that place.
That's awesome. Hey, cool.
And it's looks like it's still doing well, so I'm happy for them.
Yeah, yeah, they're still.
It's a different thing now, but like,
yeah.
I went to volunteer for something like last year for them.
Yeah,
at like some lock-in.
Yeah,
and it was the new building, so it's like I have nothing here. It's just just vague memories. It's just like
yeah.
So and then like one teacher, and you're like, I know you.
Who are you again?
Yeah, I went to my old high school back in Lancaster too, and they had just done like a complete renovation of it. You know, like the entire building was different. It was like not at all. Not when I remembered, you know.
Changes.
Yeah, that's unavoidable. Unavoidable. No, yeah, it's like no one's going to keep up that part of the school just so that I can come visit it once every 10 years.
There's so much to talk to you about. I'm not even sure we're going to get into
anything. Oh, sorry, yeah.
No, but this is good. This is what I want to talk to you about. Just so much.
Yeah.
So let me at least ask you this,
okay.
if nothing else before this. Because it's something that when you were going through the whole thing about Black Mesa came to mind. So this project that you're still working on, how much of it is like a love letter, and how much of it is just like this business process, like
now,
project?
Okay, it's when it was for free. I mean, it was 100% like no bones about it. Like we were making somebody else's game, mm-hmm. so we knew at that time there was no way we could never make a dollar off of it because it's somebody else's intellectual property, you know, it's got their characters, all this stuff. So it was like a passion project. It was like, this is, you know, one, yes, obvious like portfolio boost, you know, it's like, this is a high profile project. A lot of people are going to see it. It looks good. I'm working with a lot of talented people. It's like good for me to be a part of this project, but also it's like, it's my high school experience, you know, like 4 years of my life spent playing that game. And like I said, it's like, high school, you figure out what you like, and in college, you have to figure out like why you like it. You know, like what is it about this? You can start like you can just intellectually, you're a different person. Like you can actually think deeper about the things that you're, you know, that you're drawn to. And so, just like started like paying attention to Half-Life and how it changed my whole perception on like what a good game was and what storytelling in a game could be, and like all these things that just as I was in it, you know, as I was like doing it, in the process, like, I guess it's really what kind of kept it fresh, like you were asking earlier, is like, oh, it's, I am unlocking just new levels of understanding, you know, I'm like plumbing, like, just, I have just such deeper depths of this game than...
You were spelunking.
Yeah, totally, I mean, yeah, just like...
A word I only know thanks to that game.
Yeah, it was exactly it. I was in there deep, and like, and then also... having the excuse then on the back end to not only understand like all the, you know, I would think like the closest like analogy would be like a stage play or like a metaphor, like a movie or something like that. It's like, so there's on one level you watch the movie and it's like, oh, these characters are great. Oh, it looks so good. It's so beautiful. Like all this stuff, you know, like you're there and you're getting like the surface level of everything. But then I also had this opportunity to go behind the scenes and like, you know, in a video game, it's like you roll up your sleeves and you like go into the guts of the thing and like try to decipher other people's like programming and code and stuff like that. So it was like this huge shift in like my appreciation for the game itself. Like a game that I could like literally like probably sit here and recite to you from beginning to end, you know, or like draw a map from memory. Like this game that I knew everything about, but yet still didn't know.
And I wouldn't mind. We could totally have a different interview about
Shakespeare in the that. Park. Yeah. Like, no. It's like do the whole thing.
Gordon Freeman goes left.
Yeah. Exactly. I tell, like, exactly. Like that's, I could draw the original, you know, the facility. Like I could draw the whole Black Mesa Research Facility. But, you know, so like then taking it and yeah, getting to roll up your sleeves, go down in the guts of it, really start like taking it apart and like seeing what it's all about was also just like incredibly cool and rewarding, and just understanding everything at a different level. And so, what am I trying to answer here?
Love letter versus business project.
So the only times it was a pain in the ass would be essentially when we'd be trying to figure out when the heck to release this thing. That's where like. I mean, we would have, like, arguments over, There's this great argument that always kind of sticks out of my mind over, it was like 5 or 6 thread pages long, arguing about the colors of the male and female scientist tie and button-up shirts. And it was like a war, with sides chosen, like a line drawn in the sand. You were either, they're all going to have blue shirts and red ties, or you're on this other crazy side where, scientists had a light blue, female scientists had, a light purple shirt, and they all had, a red tie. And then